everyone. Welcome back to Business Aspirin. I'm your host, Clint Janelle, and today I have with me Caleb Dill. Caleb is with the Dry Guy Restoration out of Haslett, Texas, which is north of Fort Worth, and Caleb services the DFW market kind of in whole. Caleb, how are you, man?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Clint.
Absolutely, man. I'm excited to have you on. Excited to make this relationship since we're both here in DFW. We can do some stuff together. So I'm super excited about chatting with you on this. Let's talk for a little bit about your adulthood history and what you did and how you wound up in the restoration space. Let's talk about life and how you got where you're at.
Yeah, sure. So, I kind of grew up in a family of entrepreneurs. My aunts, uncles, my mom, they all owned and ran businesses. Primarily, like, the family business was like a corrugated box business that my grandpa started and grew it to kind of a multinational company, you know, as we were kids getting to kind of see that. So, which was really cool. And so, you know, kind of always had the aspirations to start my own business someday. Felt like I had a lot of really good influences and mentors in that. So I went to Texas A&M for college, grew up in Fort Worth, went to Texas A&M for college. And got my degree in business, as well as a certificate in entrepreneurial leadership. So took that, didn't start my own business right away, but kind of went into the corporate America world. My first, you know, in college, I did a little bit of like insurance project management, some roofing and general construction work kind of through the summers, selling roofs, putting on roofs, that kind of stuff. Got my adjuster's license. During that time, my insurance adjuster's license, really just to help me sell roofs. So I had a little bit of experience in that, and then sort of graduated college and got my first like corporate jobs. My first role was overseeing a sand and gravel mine site in Louisiana.
Okay.
So I worked for a 150-year-old business that was one of the largest mineral rights owners in the South. And I was responsible for overseeing their mine site. Traveled back and forth to Louisiana almost every week. Corporate offices here in DFW. Mine site location an hour north of Baton Rouge. Man, loved that job. Had a really, really great mentor who was my boss, who I give a ton of credit for and kind of helped me set out on the right path in my career. Made a lot of mistakes. You know, I was like 22 running a team full of miners that had been doing it 30 years, you know. Learned a lot of things the hard way. But like I said, I had a really good mentor and boss that invested a ton of time in me. So, loved that job, loved the people, loved what I did. But I had a little girl. So I had my first kid. And she started getting a little bit older. And so, you know, as much as I loved the job, it was not worth being that, you know, away from home that much. So took a step back from that, left that company, found something local and took a pretty big shift in my career and went to a transportation services company. The easiest way to understand it is basically we were like AAA for commercial trucking. So we did roadside breakdown and towing for commercial fleets.
Okay.
So we were nationwide and in Canada as well. I had about 120 employees that reported through me. I was a vice president of operations running that business.
When was the mining business job and when was the transportation? When did this
take place? Oh, man. I wish my memory is better this stuff, but probably 2014 through 2019 was the mine site. And then kind of 2019 through 20, which was the transportation company.
Okay.
Yeah. So
daughter was born in around 2019, I guess.
Yeah. Well, she was, 2014. And so I guess I was there earlier. So I probably started in 2016. So it's when she was about two, when she started to get into ballet, you know, and I was missing her ballet stuff. And, that's when it kind of really hit home, is when I started missing stuff that I was like, yeah, I can't keep doing this. And I was just getting totally and completely burnt out. It was another 24/7, 365 business. You know, we're year round, and being over the operations team was 20.
So you were home, but you weren't home.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, my wife, you know, was noticing it, and I was just super unhappy and super burnt out. And I was spending all this time, energy, stress, all that kind of stuff, making somebody else money. You know, and so left there and pretty much promised my wife and my kids. I've got three kids now, but promised my wife and my kids that, I wasn't going to work for anybody else, in my career. So I didn't know what that looked like. And again, I've got some really good mentors and stuff and some people that definitely helped me. I probably had a list of 60 different businesses at one point, just random business ideas. Like I know a lot of people maybe go into business where they've got like really strong experience or something they're really good at or passionate about, and they decide to use that experience to start a business. I was sort of the opposite. So I had the business experience. I knew how to run successful companies. I knew how to scale successful companies, but I knew I didn't want to start a transportation company. I knew I didn't want to start a mine site. So I had the business experience, but didn't know, you know, sort of what industry to apply that in. Then I fell in love with restoration. You know, I had a little bit of that insurance experience through college. You know, a couple of things I love about it, something I get passionate about and helping people. On really crappy days, our motto is making bad days better. So just something that me and the team can get passionate about, just helping people in the community when they're having issues with their home or properties. In addition, generally, I like that I don't have to compete on price. At least on insurance jobs, we do use Xactimate to bill. And so when we go sell ourselves to a customer, we don't have to bid it. In general, there are obviously exceptions to that, but we're not bidding the job. We're not trying to come in at the cheapest. Like, our pricing is pretty much set. And so I just get to sell ourselves on like really awesome customer service.
Yeah, which is important, right? Like, when you get to compete on service rather than on price, and you diffuse price as an objective, it's a pretty easy way to be there to help, especially when it's restoration, right? Because most of those people, like, they need somebody, and they need somebody right then when they make a phone call. In some cases, there's time to think about it. But for the most part, somebody woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning and stepped in a puddle of water, and they're trying to navigate, what do I do? You answer the phone. If you don't have to compete on price and they're not worried about the pricing side of it, it's a pretty easy win, right? Makes life a little bit better. So you started the Dry Guy Restoration in 2023 then, is that right?
End of 2023, yep.
Okay. So it just come through COVID and through Snowmageddon here in DFW. Yeah. And then you opted to jump into the space. What made the decision? Is it because you had the previous knowledge about roofing and a little bit of the insurance space? Is that what led to restoration over others? What was the next best competitor in terms of?
I considered roofing, but for me, you know, just in my experience in it, I didn't want to run a business that was dependent on an act of God to get busy. And so, you know, in DFW, most of the roofing is related to wind or hail events.
Sure.
And so I just saw a lot of roofing companies that it was feast or famine. Like, if there's hailstorms, they were killing it. And if there's not hailstorms, they were going out of business. And so I didn't want my business to rely on something that was out of my control. In restoration, there's a little bit of that element, right? Like, there's got to be a loss to happen, but the frequency of that is not contingent. You know, there's freeze events and stuff like that, but it's, you know, the frequency, you know, happens a lot more often, and it's not really dependent on what the economy is doing. Mostly not dependent on what weather's doing and stuff like that.
There's a core amount of losses that kind of occur. Like, water heaters going to fail at the same rate they've always failed. That's not going to change. Toilet supply lines are going to snap the same way they always have. That's not going to change. Now, maybe they come up with ways to fix some of those problems, but they seemingly aren't trying right now because that doesn't impact their industry. The water heater manufacturer industry doesn't want it to last for longer. They want the bottom to fall out of it.
Yeah.
So they get to make another sale when that happens. Okay, so let's talk about then, what are some challenges that you faced transitioning from two corporate jobs that were different industries into starting your own entrepreneurial business in the restoration space? What's some of the challenges?
So one of the toughest parts, man, was going from having a ton of resources and a large leadership team and just a big support system to, you know, starting out, man. I was a one-man show. It was, I did not hire anybody for like 6 months. So I was the technician ripping out sheetrock and floors. I was the sales guy hitting up insurance agents and plumbers. I was our accountant and I was just grinding, man. So I went from, you know, like very high level executive leadership into a very hands-on role, which was a big, big transition. And so, you know, I think navigating that was tough. You know, of course, I think we got our first customer, you know, $750 cash job. I thought we'd won the lottery, but you know, I think we got our first customer 3 days after my youngest daughter was born. You know, so, and then it was kind of off to the races. So, you know, I think at one point I worked like 90 days straight without a day off, which was tough on the family, you know, but.
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask is like, so you made this commitment to not work for anybody else and then suddenly yeah. you're working for everybody else.
Yeah.
And yeah. And you were burnt out on the time frame. And restoration's a hard space, man, because like most of the time this podcast leads somewhere to the conversation about you work when you can work, you work when there's things to be doing. And because there could be times you sit around. So how did that commitment to your bride and to your kids go when suddenly it's, you know, my youngest daughter's born and I got to take off and go do some work. And now it's, you know, Friday at 6 PM and we're trying to go to dinner and the phone rings and I got to go do some restoration work. Talk a little bit about that and the commitment that's required from your end and from your family's end and the strain or stress that can create and how you navigate that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was tough. And so we had a lot of conversations going into it. You know, I mean, like I understood the 24/7 element, the overnights, the long weeks, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, me and my wife talked about it and sort of the mindset that we took going in is like, cause you're right. I'm working more than I was in corporate America. Like I am. The difference is, like, I'm doing it for me and for my family, right? I'm not doing it for some guy on a sailboat in Portugal. And so, like, the fulfillment I get from that is just, like, totally different. And so, you know, happiness-wise, man, it's like night and day. And I'm not making what I made, you know, in executive roles. I'm making less money, but I couldn't be any happier, you know? And but as far as, like, the family and stuff, like, our mindset going in was sort of, like, hey, we don't want to, like, I don't want to be stuck doing the 40, 60 hour a week thing for the rest of my life. Like, I don't want to be tied to a job and I don't want to trade my time for money. And so there's some sacrifice that has to be made in the short term to hopefully get us there in the long term. And so, you know, plan was just, you know, and we set these expectations together, like, I'm going to have to absolutely bust it for, like, 5 to 7 years probably. And I am going to be working more. There is going to be a lot of the overnight stuff. There is going to be weekends and all that stuff. But we're willing to make that sacrifice in the short term to hopefully get the business to a point where I can bring on a good leadership team and start enjoying more time with family and being able to travel.
Have you, in this process, have you yet been able to grab some of that time and go to the ballet or go to sporting events, yeah, or any of those kind of things, the freedom that you get from being able to do your own thing. Have you experienced any of what you were chasing leaving the corporate world? Have you gotten to see the benefit of that yet?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I don't miss any of the sports or anything. You know, I coached my 3-year-old soccer team this year, and that's got to do that. What's that?
That's a nightmare in itself.
Yeah, it was so much fun. It's like herding cats, but it was a blast. And so really enjoyed doing that stuff, you know. Yeah, I mean, at this point, you know, I think, you know, I started as a like single owner operator. You know, we've got 8 employees now, and a really good team. Just recently, sort of one of the first times we did it, we took a long vacation. We took a week in Florida with just the family, and I don't think the business bugged me once. And so that was really cool to be able to do that. And then part of it too, man, is like I have a super supportive wife. all that time, especially in the beginning when I was like really, really grinding, I don't think she complained once, like ever. Like when I was getting those calls overnight, she was like, get out of bed.
Kicking you out and being like, go.
Yeah, no, but she never, I mean, she got it. You know, she understood like what our long-term goals are and that this is just a temporary thing to get there. And then two, she's an ICU nurse. And she was picking up a lot of extra shifts to pay the bills when I couldn't in the beginning, you know? So definitely couldn't have done it without that. Cause I don't think, man, I didn't take a paycheck from the business for like 7 or 8 months. And she carried us through that for sure.
That's super awesome. It's because I think that's important for people to understand too, in the entrepreneurship world, right? Like a lot of guys are going to be a technician on something and they're going to be frustrated with who they're working for and think that they can do it better. And a lot of them can. We've had plenty on here that have started that way, but you have to understand the reality of what's going to take place because you may not get a $750 job 3 days after you start. It could be weeks. And even that money, when it comes in, has to support the operational side of what you're trying to do because you got to get the next lead and you got to be in this position and be ready to bring somebody else on and navigate some of that. That's a tough part of entrepreneurship is this is all dependent upon me now. Like I have to make all of this work. So being able to find that support from the family is imperative, in my opinion, to be able to have any success in the restoration space. Because I think if you're in a spot where, you know, your wife is not happy with you and she's having to work extra shifts to support it and she's not all in, it's really easy to quit the entrepreneurship side and just go back to getting a job.
Yeah, no doubt. No, huge, huge credit to her. I mean, I really couldn't have done it. And yeah, and she was always, man, she's my cheerleader the whole time too, which makes such a big difference for a guy, you know, just to have somebody cheering you on and encouraging and pushing and all that kind of stuff too. So
yeah,
on the days I was tired and I didn't want to go visit, you know, insurance agents or plumbers, like, or go do sales or whatever, she's like, hey, go get it done. Like, you got to go sell. You told me to hold you accountable. So I'm holding you accountable, you know? So
that's great.
Yeah, for sure.
I love it. I love it. So you said you took a vacation and it doesn't seem like anything missed a beat. So let's talk about your team. Let's talk about processes and things you've implemented to help you navigate some of that. Like what, if you were looking at somebody else is going to be an entrepreneur and they're going to follow this journey, what would you suggest to them in terms of how to build some processes or something that helped you be able to take a vacation for a week?
Yeah, man. So I think like the biggest piece of it is like just people, right? Like I always joke, like people are the best part of a business and the worst part of a business. And like, I absolutely adore my team, man. And they're awesome. But it took a while to get here.
Sure it did.
And, you know, I realized like in my corporate roles, I thought I was good at hiring, but you know, I've learned that I'm actually really not that good at hiring because I had, you know, we had HR director, recruiters, all sort of vetting processes and all that kind of stuff. By the time they got to me, you know, for like final interview, like they'd already gone through a bunch of steps. Sure. And it was, you know, I was traditionally hiring like director type roles, you know, not technician roles. And so it's a very different hiring process, very different like candidate vetting and all that. Yeah, so I made a lot of bad hires, man. I made a lot of bad hires. I've had, you know, some technicians that came in and they were not great. You know, I think I went through, I hate saying this, but like, you know, I think it's good to be transparent. I had 4 office managers in like 5 months and 2 of them tried to steal from me, you know. Thankfully, they didn't. Like, you know, it's a pretty small business. I got a pretty tight grip on everything, but 2 of them tried to steal from me. And then, you know, just find the right people in the right seats. And so I've totally changed the way that I hire and all that kind of stuff. You know, and so that took a while to get where I wanted to be on that and get the team to a point where I wanted to be. Yeah, I learned some hard mistakes there for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's great that you're willing to be transparent about that because all of us have made bad hires. Like, you know, I try to listen to Gary Vee occasionally and he's like, you're going to hire, you're not, you, we all suck at hiring. The question is, how do you pivot from that? And do you do it quickly? Because we've had some in our company that we've hired that we've had way too long that we should have gotten rid of very quickly. But it sounds like you were at least willing to cut ties very quickly as well, which was important in terms of regaining control of what you were trying to do and operate and all of that. So kudos, man, on, yeah, I'm sorry you sucked at hiring for a couple of those things, but what did you change then now that you hire?
Well, so, I mean, so my most recent hire was our business development lady who's come in. She's been with me probably about 2 months now and she's killing it. She's doing awesome. And so, you know, I'm especially sensitive to like a sales role, like out representing our brand and talking to customers and all that kind of stuff. So I'm super picky. I had two headhunters helping me. And then I also, you know, had the Indeed thing going. I was hitting people up on LinkedIn and all that kind of stuff. And it probably took me 6 months to pull the trigger, like 5 to 6 months before I hired somebody for that role. And I probably interviewed in person. I don't know how many I talked to on the phone, but in person, I probably interviewed over 20 people.
Nice.
And so, you know, I think I sort of look at hiring now as sort of like a three-legged stool. And like, I think it's a combination of three things. And one is experience, right? What kind of relevant experience do they have in the job that I want them to perform? What is their like natural skill set? Like, what are they gifted at? What do they enjoy doing? Like, what's their aptitude level for whatever it is you're asking them to do? And then the last thing, and probably the hardest, is like the cultural fit. Like, are they a good person? Are they trustworthy? You know, are they going to fit with our core values and that kind of stuff? So, you know, so with her, I think, man, we probably spent 10 to 12 hours together interviewing before I brought her on and made her an offer. And, you know, multiple interviews. I also put her through a personality and sales aptitude test. And then, you know, she did well on that. And then I actually sent her an assignment, like a sales assignment. That she spent 4 to 6 hours on. I paid her for it because I wasn't going to ask her to do work for free. But basically made her do like a day of sales. And then I had her come out and we did a shadow day together. We went and visited some customers and cold visits and all that kind of stuff just to see how she would do, but probably also just as important, like make sure she understood what the role was and what it looked like. And so, you know, that's pretty over the top, I think. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. You know, what's funny though, is like, I do some stuff with Alex Ramazzi. I don't know if you know who that is, but he does acquisition.com and he does some scaling business things. And one of the things that he says is similar to what you did, is actually do a significant period of courting this person to take you where you need them to be and then help them, you know, help understand what they're really capable of. And he would say that you give them an assignment, pay them for an assignment, and you paid her for 4 hours, but she probably spent 12 working on it, trying to figure out how to do what you needed her to do. But, you know, that's the beautiful part of it, is like she gave you more than what you really paid for, but maybe she's learning the role. Did she have relevant experience in the restoration space or what market?
Not restoration. Oh, and I hired a lot of experience, or I'm sorry, I interviewed a lot of experienced restoration salespeople. I think they're challenging to, you know, hire. I think a lot of people are trying to hire experienced restoration business development people right now. But she didn't have any direct restoration experience, but she did have commercial construction experience. She was doing remodels for like Walmart and some other like large commercial facilities. And then she did have some sales roles in her career as well. You know, honestly, so much of it was just like so we talked about three-legged school, right? The experience, the natural skill set, and the cultural fit. And she checked the box like big time on the cultural fit, and on like the natural skills and like aptitude and the sales testing and all that kind of stuff. And so, and then she didn't have any direct restoration experience, but she did have, you know, construction experience.
Sure. She understood a little bit about the space.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Well, I think that's important. I like the fact that you're talking about the three-legged stool, because the reality is it's difficult. Like for me, you can have a really high performer. Somebody can do spectacular at sales and be a cancer in your organization. And that's not going to be a good fit. So for us, like, being a part of understanding who we are and our culture, I think, is really important. We try to tell people up front, because it's not good for anybody to walk into a situation where you don't understand who these people are and what they operate like, and then you get blindsided by it and you hate being there because they're way too conservative for me or whatever, right? Like, you'd be like, well, these guys, they got American flags on their shirts. I can't believe that they would. Then we don't need to be together, right? Like, this is who we are. This is how we operate. And we want people to understand that up front, because I think culture is vitally important. I do like the fact that, you know, she had some relevant experience in regards to the sales side of things. I think that's great for you, man. So I'm super excited about that. Let's talk about challenges right now that you're navigating. What's your biggest struggle right now in your entrepreneurship journey in the restoration space?
Yeah, so just as a company, we have a big emphasis. I told you I brought sales lady on. Just big emphasis on sales right now. Up until, she's our first full-time salesperson, business development person. So we've grown a ton over the first 2.5 years, just sort of organically. Didn't have a really strong like sales presence. We're really, really lucky to get, you know, a lot of customer referrals and stuff like that. So we've been really successful growing, despite really not having a very big marketing budget. So we're kind of shifting on that. And, you know, like for me, it's sort of like year one was sort of like proof of concept. Like, I was new to the industry, had to get my bearings straight, make sure that I knew I could actually like make money at this, and that I enjoyed it and all that kind of stuff. So then like year two was bringing on a team, right? So hiring not just technicians, but starting to hire a leadership team as well, or train up a leadership team, and get like processes in place, a foundation in place, and all the right people in the right seats. And then, so now I'm kind of like shifting my focus of like, all right, I know we can make money doing it, right? I know we enjoy it. I feel like I have a really good team to execute now. And so like, I'm ready to throw gasoline on the fire and start investing in marketing. That's a big focus. And then on the flip side, I know this is true for a lot of small businesses, restoration or not, but like cash flow, you know, like one of the biggest surprises for me in starting my own business was like looking at our P&L and it's showing how much money we made. And then me like scratching my head, like, where is it?
did I drop it somewhere in the process?
Yeah, like, I don't have that money.
What do we do with all this money we made?
Yeah. And so, you know, we run our books on accrual, right? So it's not always a good reflection of cash flow. And we, you know, I can run cash reports too. But man, the challenge, and I haven't solved this yet, but the challenge for us is like, I have all this money tied up in receivables, but I'm basically carrying no payables, right? Like, I'm getting paid in 30, 60, 90 days from insurance. And then I'm paying my subs and most of my vendors, I'm paying weekly.
Sure.
And so that difference between our receivables and payables is where all my profit's tied up. And so just trying to navigate that, you know, meeting like with banking relationships and trying to explore like different ways of trying to improve that. So that's been a challenge, is like, you know, just.
Do you think you have instances where stuff's slipping through the cracks?
Like, you're, as far as like how we're spending on our spending?
Well, no, in terms of like what you know, are you capturing all of your billable correctly and getting all that worked out? Or you think stuff's being missed there? Or, you know, are you calculating the right amount of equipment on a project to ensure that you're generating, you know, hey, this project should have had 10 fans and we only put 8. We missed 2 fans for this period of time. If we do that over and over again, what is that revenue?
Oh, for sure.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. For sure. I know that's happening. Like, anybody that tells you that it's not happening at some level probably doesn't have a good understanding of it, right? Like, you're not 100% optimizing every single mitigation job. But I will say, you know, one of the things, I told you I didn't have any experience coming to the industry. One of the things that I did was hire a really good consultant, like operations consultant. And so they've been with me even since before I started the business, like helping me get started. And I'm still with them today. And in the beginning, man, I was going out and doing jobs and, you know, very little experience. I had my certifications and all that kind of stuff, but, not a lot of real world experience. And so I'd send, you know, my stuff in to have an invoice written And they'd be like, man, you missed this, you missed that, you could have built this, you have line items here. And so it was a long process to get there. But, you know, I feel like we're way better at it now than we were before. But it sort of just took our consultant like constantly working with us on like, hey, you should have added this or you should have done that or whatever. So like our average invoice on the mitigation side has gone up like a few thousand dollars since when we started.
Sure. Just
so, being ignorant, for sure. There's still
in there, right?
Yeah.
It's just the ignorance of the space and billing and all those kinds of things, for sure.
Yeah. But even now, I know it's not 100% optimized. You know, like I know we could be probably adding some stuff. I mean, we learned new like tricks and all that kind of stuff. Like, just recently, we've been using them the whole time, but we just started adding like boot covers.
Yeah.
You know, not a big line item, but like.
Yeah. But you're still paying for them. I'm still buying a box of boot covers and I'm not charging for them.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What is your primary market right now? Like, what do you do most of?
So we're probably 85% residential and getting a lot heavier into the commercial now. And as far as like where we get our jobs, I try to stay as diversified as we possibly can. And so we try to get it from as many different referral sources as possible. But a lot of our work comes from plumbers. And we have a little bit of a unique, like strategy with plumbers. And, you know, last time I looked, we got like 43% of our revenue from customer referrals.
Okay.
Which we're super proud of.
Whatsoever, or are you avoiding program work right now?
We don't do any program work. Yeah, I'm avoiding it. So it's something that like keep kicking the can down the road. Like as I grow, you know, I
don't take it. If you can,
I know. And so I'm kind of trying to take the hard route, right? Like I'm trying to like, I know it's easy work and it's easy to get revenue and it's easy to get jobs, right? But I know it's also a lot lower profit. And so.
Yeah, then you get, it's just tough, man. The TPA side of things is just such a beating, such a nightmare. Do you, are you guys strictly water mitigation?
No, so we do. So that was kind of part of what we did in like year two as well. We were 100% water mitigation, and then we added contents, recon, and environmental, which is asbestos and mold. So we added all really within the last like 6 to 8 months, we added, you know, those three additional services.
Nice.
Yeah. And so still, you know, learning stuff on those, you know, as far as the, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think we just got our mold license even just like 2 months ago, probably. So that's like brand new.
I think that'll be valuable again coming up soon because I think the insurance world has created. So 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago now, it's 30 years ago now. I'm just old. The carpet cleaning industry created the mold industry, and partly because they thought they were drying things well, but they didn't have the technology to dry things well when stuff flooded. And it was mostly always carpet cleaners that were doing the restoration side of things 30 years ago. I think we're in a position now because of what's happened in the insurance space regarding, you know, in DFW, houses have doubled in value over the last decade, right? Everybody's house is worth way more. Now I have a 2%, maybe a 3% deductible, depending on what the peril is. So, you know, if I had a $300,000 house, it's now $600,000, and my deductible is now $12,000 for a water loss. I think a lot of people are looking at, well, I'm just going to go get a fan from Home Depot or something and put this fan on it and dry the carpet because that's all they know. I think we're in a position we're going to wind up with another mold, heavy mold environment in the near future. And so I think having that's going to be good for you. I think that's probably a smart move. Brother, there's a lot of questions we could talk about, but we're at 35 minutes already on this podcast.
Oh, man, that flew by. Great
conversation. Yeah. It went fast, right? And just good convo. But I want to respect your time. So talk to me. What is, if you had a single nugget or maybe two that you would want to share with somebody that's going to get started, what is it that you would say to them that was going to get started in entrepreneurship journey, mostly in the service industry?
Man, this is a great question. Man, I wish it was like a magic bullet. You know, but I'll say this, my uncle was really successful business guy, even better, like family guy. Like he always, you know, he always taught me growing up. Like he used to say, and so now I say it too, is like, I'll never be the smartest guy in the room right? I'll never be like the best looking. I'll never be the funniest or whatever, but I'll always be the hardest working. And man, it was hard work getting a business off the ground. It's still hard work, you know? And so like, and there's stuff you got to do that you don't want to, you know? And so you just got to grind, man. And I don't think there's a shortcut to it. And like, it pays off, right? Like, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, if you're successful, but I think you just got to work your butt off and grind.
And I think there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, I think you're right. Like you've got to be able to be resilient, because again, if it gets hard and you're not resilient, you're going to fail and you're going to just go back to a job that you hated to begin with anyway. So grind this thing out, man, grind it out. I think that's important. I love that, man. I love that you said that. I love your take on hiring. I love the fact that you've had some mentors and you talk about having consultants. I think there's a lot of good things people, if they pay attention to what you're saying through this podcast, really could grab something and kind of make it work. So tell us how people find you, Caleb. Like, how would somebody get a hold of you if they wanted restoration service from you, and or they wanted to partner with you and tag with you in terms of, hey, they need some kind of service here in the Metroplex?
Yeah, for sure. So our website, it's simple. It's just thedryguy.com. And then, you know, our phone number is on there. That'd be the best way to contact us, is just via our website at thedryguy.com.
Perfect. Well, Caleb, man, I appreciate you being on, man. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks so much, Clint. I enjoyed it, man.
Take care.